Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Manji Dawoodi of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, who discusses the response of the Muslim community to a threefold increase in hate crimes targeting mosques and individual Muslims across the U.S. Mike Lawler, Connecticut Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning, who explains the rationale behind proposed juvenile justice reforms that many see as a model for the entire nation. And author Les Leopold, who talks about his new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after Presidents Barack Obama and Raul Castro agreed to normalize diplomatic relations, Cuba is looking for economic relief and new investment. Yet the announcement of closer U.S.-Cuba ties prompted a new flow of refugees out of Cuba and a large influx of American tourists visiting Cuba for the first time. A recent flurry of fiscal agreements could bolster the Cuban economy. Paris Club creditor nations have forgiven $8.5 billion of Cuba's $11.1 billion debt and restructured payments on the remainder with easy terms. But the deal imposes severe penalties if Cuba falls behind again. Cuba and the U.S. agreed to resume commercial air flights between the two countries once a new protocol on safety inspections is agreed to. President Obama has expressed an interest in visiting Cuba if he can freely meet with Cuban dissidents. Earlier in 2015, the U.S. and Cuba signed agreements on environmental protection and drug enforcement. Many Washington officials, including the Secretaries of Agriculture, Commerce, and State, along with dozens of lawmakers, have visited Havana, the highest-level government contacts in decades. U.S. and Cuban officials have even started discussing their oldest grievances, opening negotiations to settle billions of dollars in U.S. property claims and Cuban counterclaims. James Williams of the group Engage Cuba told the Washington Post that the Cubans have been overwhelmed with a surge of interest in commercial ventures, with companies making overtures but not a lot of clarity about how to make a deal. The Kurdish population, over 30 million strong across the Middle East, remains the largest ethnic group in the world without their own nation-state. But optimism is growing for the future establishment of a new Kurdish republic, given the Kurds' strong alliance with Washington and recent military victories over Islamic State militants in both Iraq and Syria. For Syrian Kurds, the four-year civil war has created new opportunities, with the carving out of enclaves in regions that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has relinquished. In these areas, the Kurds have moved to establish autonomy that includes advancing Kurdish language education, a movement toward gender equality, and decision-making structures generally inclusive of Arabs and the other groups living in their areas of control. But there is a dark side, too. Human rights groups accuse Syrian Kurdish militias of recruiting child soldiers and destroying Arab villages. And in both the Iraqi and Syrian contexts, internal rivalries, autocratic tendencies, and fraught relations with Arab neighbors have slowed progress toward independence. Over the past 12 years, the rate of juveniles sentenced to prison or other correctional facilities in the U.S. dropped by 53%, according to a new analysis from the Pew Charitable Trusts. Crunching data from the U.S. Department of Justice, Pew calculated that the juvenile sentencing rate fell in 49 states between 2001 and 2013, with the rate dropping by 50% or more in 26 states. The rate increased only in North Dakota and the District of Columbia. Connecticut is the leader in juvenile justice reform, where juvenile incarceration fell by 75%, without a concurrent spike in violent crimes or any added costs for taxpayers. The state's innovative juvenile justice initiatives are discussed in an interview later in this broadcast. Researchers from the Pew Trust attributed the falling incarceration rate to a decrease in violent crime among juveniles and recent reforms in the juvenile justice system. The Justice Policy Institute says diverting juveniles from prison and the use of more alternative sentences has had a real impact. Jason Zeidenberg, director of research and policy at the Institute, believes the success of juvenile justice reforms could provide a blueprint for the country to achieve its goal of reducing mass incarceration for adults. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since the November 13th ISIS attacks in Paris that left 130 dead and 368 injured, followed by the December 2nd San Bernardino, California mass shooting by a radical Islamist couple that killed 14 and wounded 22 others, the incidence of anti-Muslim hate crimes in the U.S. has increased dramatically. According to the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino, the number of attacks on Muslims in their houses of worship has risen almost threefold and include assaults on women dressed in traditional veils or hijabs, vandalism, arson, and shootings. While the number of anti-Muslim crimes over the past 5 years has averaged 12.6 per month, in the 4 weeks following the Paris attacks, the number rose to 37. According to news reports, a severed pig's head was thrown from a car at a mosque in Philadelphia. A pregnant Muslim woman who was wearing a headscarf in San Diego was hit in the stomach while walking down the street, and an Uber driver in Pittsburgh was shot by a passenger who thought he was a Muslim. An anti-Muslim hate crime in Connecticut took place on November 14th, when a 48-year-old man was arrested after he allegedly fired multiple shots from guns he owns at a mosque near his home in the city of Meriden. No one was hurt in the attack, and the FBI later found anti-Muslim messages posted on his Facebook account. Your reporter spoke with Manji Dawoodi, executive director of the Connecticut chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, who discusses how local mosques and national groups are responding to the rise in hate crimes and concern about the toxic effect of hateful rhetoric coming from many of the candidates running for the Republican Party presidential nomination.
Primarily, our concern is with the safety and security of our community as places of worship, as individuals. We have quite a good number of our women in our community. They wear the headscarf, and so they are easily identified as Muslims. And so we are concerned that they might be a target of hate incidents or hate crimes. There's an increased number of attacks on specifically on houses of worship all across the country. And this is something that we as a community have to face and as a country. I think we need to take a hard look at ourselves, examine the real causes that is putting people in harm's way, innocent people. Everyone has to share the responsibility for this. And I think our political leaders need to take a look at themselves and seriously consider the words that they utter in the campaign trail specifically, that those words do carry weight, and they might contribute to the atmosphere that we live in, that facilitates and makes people who are at the fringe extremists find in those words in some of these politicians' rhetoric a way for them to act out on those fears, on the ignorance. While some of the politicians think that attacking minorities and attacking specifically Muslims might increase their polls numbers, might increase their money in their bank accounts, but it has other consequences, which is putting the safety and security of innocent people on the line.
Republican presidential candidates, foremost Donald Trump, have targeted Muslims with his campaign rhetoric. First of all, talking about how the U.S. military should target terrorists, families, the women and children of terrorists or accused terrorists. We've had, of course, his infamous statements recently where he's called for a ban on all Muslim immigration to the United States, as well as previous statements calling for a database of all Muslims living in this country. What is your reaction to a major political party in this country and their foremost, most popular candidate espousing such hateful messages to the American people?
Right. I think we can safely say that Donald Trump and Ben Carson and some of these Republican candidates are, to tell you the truth, are dangerous for our national security. I mean, the rhetoric that they are using, the hateful message that they are giving to a certain segment of our society, that segment is receiving it, is cheering for it, and is embracing it, is dangerous. It is dividing us. It is putting our community at risk, and it should be condemned, and it should be rejected with very clear message that there's no ambiguity, there's no buts. Overall, I think the leadership on the Republican side came out and rejected what Donald Trump was suggesting, from preventing Muslims from coming to this country and trying to blame all Muslims for the acts of a few terrorists. But I think overall we are disappointed in the Republican leadership. They have allowed this to happen for quite a long time. This rhetoric accusing the Muslim community overall and speaking in language that is, quite frankly, is divisive and it is demeaning, degrading to our people and our religion. A great faith like the faith of Islam has been around for centuries, been respected around the world. Is being followed by 1.5 billion Muslims. The overwhelming majority of them are peaceful Muslims, just like anybody else who go on about their life every day. But to allow some of these candidates who are competing for the highest position in the land, in the United States, to be talking that language is really disappointing. So we think that the Republican Party is at a crossroad. We think and we hope that they will make the right choice eventually, is to cut any candidate that does not adhere to the norm, if you will, to adhere to a principled message that respects the rights of others, that respects all religious minorities in this country. I think they need to cut them loose. I think they need to distance themselves from them, even if it is at the expense of losing the presidential election. I think they might lose the election, but save the party and save the country. But I think if they allow this to happen and to go on, I think that eventually they will lose the elections and they will lose the party. So I hope that they come to their senses, and they come to their senses quickly.
That was Manji Daoudi, Executive Director of the Connecticut Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Learn more about how American Muslims are responding to a rise in hate crimes by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Until a few years ago, Connecticut was among the most backward states in the nation regarding its treatment of juveniles in the criminal justice system. It was among three states, with New York and North Carolina, that treated all juveniles 16 years and older as adults, regardless of the criminal charges. Teenagers were often the victims of abuse in prison, and their public criminal records, even when they didn't result in prison time, followed them the rest of their lives. Records which made them ineligible for student loans, approval to live in public housing, or to receive benefits from government programs like food stamps. Recidivism for these young offenders was high. Legislation to raise the age at which offenders would be adjudicated as adults was raised to 18 and enacted before Connecticut Democratic Governor Dana Malloy took office in 2011. The governor, recently elected as chair of the Democratic Governors Association, has now proposed going further, designating all those 20 years of age or under involved in the state's criminal justice system to be considered a juvenile. Among other measures, the governor proposes allowing some defendants up to age 25 with low-level offenses to have their cases heard confidentially, their criminal records sealed, and the possibility of having those records expunged. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mike Lawler, Governor Malloy's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning, at the state's Office of Policy and Management. Here, Lawler, a former state representative, explains the rationale behind these proposed juvenile justice reforms that many observers believe could serve as a model for the rest of the nation.
Governor Malloy is completely convinced that people under 21 are definitely not fully formed adults. And under 25, it's pretty clear that your brain is not fully developed. So the issue is, can we change the criminal justice system to deal with the reality that young people are not fully culpable if they break the law. And so the governor has seen this in Germany. He was there earlier this year. And up to age 21, the German courts make a decision whether or not someone should be prosecuted as an adult or as a juvenile. And I think the trend is definitely in that direction. The science definitely indicates that. And I think the governor wants there to be a conversation in our state whether or not we should have special rules governing people under 21, in addition to that, special protections for people under 25 when they do these relatively minor kinds of offenses that potentially could affect their entire life, given the fact that everything you do is easily accessible online. And so updating our criminal justice system to reflect modern realities is a priority for the governor. And I think we're very confident that the legislature will agree that this is the right thing to do, and we'll have a very different system.
Can you give some examples of the kinds of crimes that 18 to 21-year-olds commit where they could be treated as juveniles if these changes go into effect?
So every state has a juvenile justice system, and every state has a rule that says that the most serious crimes get prosecuted in adult court, even for people as young as 15, 14, 13 years old, including Connecticut. So murder, for example, would automatically go to adult court. But the vast majority of crimes that are committed are not in that category. And so the question is, if you're 17 years old and you get caught possessing drugs or selling drugs or breach of peace or whatever, then should the fact that you've been arrested and the fact that you've been prosecuted and convicted make it impossible later on in life for you to succeed, right, in a job, in a family, whatever it happens to be? And so what the governor has said is that we know based on the science that your brain is not fully developed until you have reached age 25. And so should we have a justice system that acknowledges that reality and on a case-by-case basis decide who should be prosecuted, who should be handled in a juvenile system where the consequences are not lifelong? And that's really what we're talking about. So he's proposed that the legislature talk about this, think about it, come up with a system that makes a cutoff at age 21 or 20 or whatever it happens to be, but acknowledge that people under 25 should be treated differently. And so we're very confident that we can do this. The extraordinary success of Connecticut's Raise the Age initiative has really provided the foundation for the governor's goal of saying, well, maybe 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds should be put in the same category. Because if our goal is to reduce crime, all we know for sure is that at least in Connecticut, we've been extraordinarily successful using this very focused initiative for younger offenders. And if we can add 18, 19, 20-year-olds to this mix, maybe we can get the same results.
Mike Lawler, what kind of changes do you think we'll see in Connecticut if these changes go through of young people being considered juveniles in the criminal justice system?
It's related to in a change the way our government, our society, deals with young people who are acting out, right? So 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago, they're likely to be arrested. They're more likely to get suspended from school or expelled from school. And that's not happening now. Realize that arresting, expelling, suspending children from school is making it more likely that they get into trouble, get arrested, get incarcerated down the road. We know that for sure. We've had these national studies in Texas in particular that shows that these decisions, if you're trying to reduce crime, then doing things like suspending, expelling, arresting children in school makes it more likely they'll commit crime in the future.
Okay.
So if you can stop doing that, you'll have less crime in the future. We know that for sure.
That was Mike Lawler, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's Undersecretary for Criminal Justice Policy and Planning. Find more information and commentary on Connecticut's juvenile justice reform initiatives by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The American dream for many has turned into a nightmare, with millions of workers stuck in dead-end, low-paid jobs and few prospects for a brighter future. For the younger generation, lucky enough to afford a college education, many are now confronted by the stark reality of being burdened with tens of thousands of dollars in tuition debt and limited career opportunities. Inequality is at an all-time high in the U.S., with the most unequal income distribution across the entire industrialized world. One signpost of the major changes in the U.S. economy can be seen in the dramatic shift in the pay ratio between the top 100 CEOs and average workers, which was 45 to 1 in 1970, but today stands at 829 to 1. Other factors contributing to growing economic disparity include the deregulation of Wall Street, a tax code favoring the wealthiest Americans, the decline in the power of labor unions, the offshoring of good-paying manufacturing jobs, and the slashing of critical social safety net programs. While the trend of worsening inequality has been a feature of the U.S. economy over the last 35 years, the 2011 Occupy Wall Street movement, the ongoing campaign for a $15 minimum wage, and the popularity of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign are all indicators that many Americans are increasingly angry over diminished living standards and joining others to demand change. Your reporter spoke with Les Leopold, author, co-founder, and director of the Labor Institute in New York City, who talks about his new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist's Guide to Economic Justice, which urges the building of a new national progressive movement.
Between 1947 and 1980, roughly, as productivity went up in the United States, so did the real wage of the average worker. That's how you got that robust middle class. And virtually every segment of society improved. Yes, there were differences by race and gender, but there was improvement going on all over the place, which allowed us to tackle those problems. After 1980, a new economic policy came into the United States that was embraced by both political parties. And it was, we call it the Better Business Climate model. Academics call it neoliberalism. But it had three basic tenets. It was cut taxes primarily on the wealthy, cut back government regulations on the economy, and cut back social spending and labor rights so that people would have more incentive to go out and work. And this was supposed to lead to a tremendous economic boom. Profits would go up, investment would go up, and jobs and income would rise for everyone. But the dirty little secret was in that little patch of deregulation. Deregulating AT&T or trucking or airlines is one thing. They also deregulated finance. And that absolutely tore the economy apart. That's the primary driver of runaway inequality, because when they deregulated finance, they set in motion what we call financial strip mining. Rather than adding value to corporations, finance found ways to take money and wealth out of corporations and into Wall Street, so that by 2006, 40% of all corporate profits went to Wall Street firms. They only had 5% of the employment. They had 40% of all the profits. The core of the book, the analysis, is to show how this financial strip mining actually works. For me, it was an eye-opening story.
I think one of the most important points you bring out in the book is that record inequality in the United States is not a result of some accident of history or some natural economic cycle gone wrong, but our inequality is actually a natural outcome of conscious policies chosen by politicians from our two major political parties. When you look at what happened over these years, Les, do you believe the outcome that we've now seen with the divide between haves and have-nots growing ever wider is something that was desired by these political parties that signed on to what you call the Better Business Climate?
I think it's a complicated story, because I think what happened was when they unleashed Wall Street, they set in motion a process that fed on itself. This financial strip mining is absolutely unbelievable, because when they deregulated, it allowed corporate raiders to come in and buy up companies by the bucketful. And after a while, this happened to thousands of companies. And they loaded these companies up with debt. It was like it's as if you bought a car and then with debt, and then the car pays back the loan instead of you paying back the loan. So yes, the people who put the policy into place, I don't think saw this coming. But once it started happening, then the rich financiers used all their lobbying muscle. Both political parties started to go after this money, this campaign money, and it became more and more deregulation. President after president deregulated Wall Street more and more and more, and more money got strip mined out of corporations into the coffers of Wall Street.
You close your book with a chapter titled An Open Letter to New Movement Organizers. Les, why don't you encapsulate the main message that you have there, that a progressive, multi-issue organizing drive has to happen to address all these issues simultaneously and get away from the single-issue organizing model,
exactly.
Silos and such.
Right. I've been engaged in dialogue with younger organizers, and it's been very fruitful. And there's a recognition now that the way we've organized ourselves for the last 30 years is good, but not good enough. We've been organized around single issues that I term silos. We're very, very good within the silos, but overall, we've been losing ground. And so the letter is a call to younger movement organizers to start thinking about building a broad national movement with a coherent agenda that cuts through the silos, that makes the silos more porous. This is a big challenge because silos are supported often by foundations that have staff that are also broken into silos, and you get this kind of reinforcement again and again and again, but it's not going to work. We need a much broader mass movement that starts to talk about, in general, the country we want to see. I think the younger generation of organizers can do it. The talent's there, and I think we need to help them. I'm very fortunate I get a chance to go around and give a lot of talks to groups ranging from like 100 to 1,000. And at the end of the talks, I say, how many people here would like to be trained to be an economics educator the way the populace had? They had 6,000 of them back in the 1880s. We need about 30,000 now. And about 95% of the people raise their hands and volunteer. So this book is designed to be kind of a primer for those volunteers. It has questions at the end of each chapter. You can use it as in a book club, a study guide. You can drive your relatives nuts over the holidays because, you know, it's got over 100 charts and graphs, so you'll be armed to the teeth. But really what we want to do is build a national economics education campaign to be the infrastructure for a broader movement.
That was Les Leopold, author of the new book titled Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. For more views on the causes of and antidotes to economic inequality in the U.S., visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.